I greet you all in Jesus' name. It's good to be here in New York. We hear about Cornerstone from time to time at Ridgeview in Missouri. Some people from Ridgeview sometimes come up here from time to time, looking at you, Brother Huber. And we have some other connections through Stan and Nancy's family, so that's a blessing. Sorry, Stan and Nancy, you go away to faraway exotic places and you hear the home people speak, so that's the way it works out sometimes. So anyway, you're all welcome to come to Missouri when you can. I have a little bit of business to take care of here first, so I was looking through the directory before I came here and I noticed a name, and so I'm curious this morning if there is a Catherine Zook here. Would you raise your hand? Okay. I'm not sure if you remember me, but a little over 40 years ago, in a little green schoolhouse in Buffalo Valley, Pennsylvania, you taught me to read in first and second grade.
Do you mean your son?
This is correct. And I did not know you were here, or I'm quite certain that I haven't seen you since first and second grade, so I hereby thank you for teaching me to read. It has been a good thing, has sometimes got me into trouble, but that was a gift, and I thank you for that. So the wheels of life have a way of coming around. I did go on to be a teacher for many years, so all right. I would like to share a message here this morning, called out of darkness into marvelous light. In this verse, Cornerstone, this is for you. You are a chosen congregation, a royal priesthood and holy nation, a peculiar people, that you should show forth the praises of him who hath called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. That is what you've been called to. I'd like to think about that subject a little bit. How many of you here this morning have relatives, maybe even close family, who have traded off, maybe over a period of time, have traded off their separated Anabaptist lifestyle for more mainstream American culture? How many of you have some relatives or close friends like that? Okay, so yeah, good part of the congregation here. They've maybe gradually drifted away from a separate road and have become more mainstream in their appearance, entertainments, worldview, and eventually ethics, maybe. And you probably know, too, from any of them, that they testify of Jesus' great work the whole time they're doing that, right? And very much in God's will. And then how many of you have had relatives in that stream who have, it's been enough of years that the testimony of what the Lord's doing for them has already faded a little bit, and they've come to difficult times in their families, such as divorce and so forth. How many of you have relatives like that? Okay. Where the testimony that they once had as they made that journey has become dimmed by the realities that they've run into and the pain that they have encountered in their lives. And, you know, too often I feel that the discussion about the question of walking a separate road becomes too distracted by these discussions about separation and the layers of custom that has formed around the Mennonite traditions and how we dress and so forth. And we tend to put everybody in nice little boxes. And well, if you're part of this conference, then you have the little ribbons off your covering. And if you're part of this conference, you have a certain kind of car color. And if you're part of here, and we have the whole spectrum laid out, and you go to some big, I don't know what you have up here, produce auction or something, and you see all the plain people. And if you've grown up in this, you can spot them and label them, and you know exactly where they all belong. And they're on this big spectrum from conservative to not very noticeable. And we think that that's what the subject of separation is somehow identified as, and And it's really quite true, of course, that we are visually oriented people. We do label people at sight, on the spot. We kind of identify them. But I think that it's unfair that the real subject of what we're called to be as apart from the world becomes too clouded in these details. And the idea of being called to walk a different road is not given the emphasis it should be. I want you to start in Hebrews 11. My first point is that the Old Testament men of God, the patriarchs, pretty much every one of them was called out to follow a separate path. And so, Noah, build a boat, Noah. You're going to do something different than everybody else. You're going to put all the animals in there. And yes, it's weird, but you're going to do it that way, and it's going to save your family, and everyone else is going to perish. Abraham, get out of your country. Get away from your relatives. Get on the road, Abraham. I'll show you where to go. You just get out of here. Joseph was sent to Egypt, and then his brothers came, and he said, well, where are they going to be? Well, I don't want them with the rest of the Egyptians. I want you to be in Goshen, be a little away from the others. And so then you have Moses, who grows up in the lap of luxury and all the power and prestige of Egypt, and God says, no, I have a job for you. I want you to take the people out of here, get them out of here. So they went out in the wilderness, and God sat down with Moses and gave this long list of Leviticus and Numbers and Deuteronomy and what are so much of the Levitical law is about. How to make sure that your families don't become polluted with the ways of the people around you. Be separate. You may not do it this way. You may not eat food this way like they do. You may not sacrifice the idols and dress and your family. The morals of your family are going to be different than the Amorites around you. And so, very clear, verse 13 here in Hebrews 11. These all died in faith, not having received the promises, but having seen them afar off, and were persuaded of them and embraced them and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. For they that say such things declare plainly that they seek a country. And truly, if they had been mindful of that country from whence they came out, they might have had opportunity to have returned. But now they desire a better country, that is, an heavenly. Wherefore God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he hath prepared for them a city. By faith Abraham, when he was tried, offered up Isaac. And he that had received the promises offered up his only begotten son, of whom it was said that in Isaac shall thy seed be called. And so on. We keep reading the whole. But the tone of the Old Testament patriarch's life was one of, I do not belong here. I have been called out on a different road. And so we have the New Testament echo when of course, Jesus had a lot to teach about the narrow way. We might look at that in a bit. But Paul just says it very simply. Set your love on the things up there, not on the things here. I have a higher calling. So, we are called, number two, we are called out of the crowd to follow a different leader. We see Jesus in the opening chapters of the Gospels. He's walking by the seaside. He's walking through the markets. He's walking places. And he says, Peter, John, Matthew, come with me. I have a different kind of job for you. You follow me. Follow me. And then he sat them down, and he sits down, and he says very hard things. He says, you know, the way of the kingdom of heaven is to go through this little door over here. It's a very little door, and if you look in the door, you see the road is not very nice. The door is kind of hard to squeeze through, and it's sort of uphill. It's not very popular. And I'm going to call a lot of people to come through this door, but very few people are going to want to do it. Most of them will look at the door and they'll say, are you kidding? I'm not going in that door. That looks ridiculous. I'm going to go with where everyone else is going. Jesus said, not many people are going to go through the door. Well, that's not exactly, some of us are contrarian by nature, and, if the whole world is walking that way, we'll walk the opposite way here just because some people are like that. But for most of us, if we're presented with an option, and the people say, well, over here's where everybody is, that's sort of where the thing is, that's what's going on, but here's this strange option, you can go through this little door, and it'll turn out better for you. Most of us are like, well, that doesn't look safe. It doesn't look something. I guess we're going to go with where everyone else is going. That's sort of natural to us. And so Jesus said, only a few people are going to go through this door. You might recall the era of the 1890s and 1910s and 1920s, where there was a lot of emphasis through the Sunday school movement, the missions movement, in the Protestant churches and the Mennonite churches as well, that we're going to have the whole wide world for Jesus, like the song says. The whole world is going to know, and the kingdom of peace is going to be ushered in, and there's going to be this worldwide revival. Actually, Jesus said, that's completely wrong. There's never going to be any worldwide revival. Not here, not now, not till another age comes in. Jesus says that you're going to take the gospel to the whole world, but there's a very difficult truth at the bottom of it here, and that is that one or two here and there, a few people are going to make it in the door, and the others are going to walk on. That's the nature of the kingdom of heaven. That seems kind of cramped. It seems kind of a narrow view of the kingdom, but that's what Jesus says. Everyone could hear, only a few people are going to go through. And so we can conclude that if you don't like the stigma of being different, you won't fit in the kingdom of heaven. Because by sheer arithmetic, you're going to be one of the few. If you don't like to be different from the multitude of people, you don't fit into the kingdom of heaven. Because Jesus said that's the way it is. So if you're really self-conscious about your stuff and how you look and what people think of your truck and your dress and your hairstyle and how many children you have and whatever else the issues are that you're different from the main culture around us, if you're self-conscious about those things and you try to avoid those things, you just might be on the broad road already. Because at the bottom of this teaching, Jesus said, it's going to be the one or two over here, and it's going to be everybody else over here. And so the nature of following King Jesus in the kingdom starts with being willing to be different than everybody else around you in the main culture. So, I don't know who to even bring this challenge to, but if you're young people and you feel the power of the pull to buy those, the fashion labels and the running shoes and all the things that are so popular in the world's culture and that fashion tells you this is the cool stuff to wear right now, and you want to fit in, you want to look good, you want people to see that, just know that that is completely broad road thinking, 100%, because Jesus said, come this way, we're going to go somewhere else than what the fashion retailers have for you. That's a hard truth, but it's what Jesus taught, because, if I go and try to wear and do the things that the God of this world says, this is what you want, this is your stuff, this is how to be in and look, then when I put that on, when I engage with that, I am saying to everybody, see, I'm on your side. I'm like you. I'm like everybody else. And Jesus says, no, I've called you somewhere else. And if that's uncomfortable, then he says, there's going to come a day when I'm going to be ashamed of you. If you're ashamed of me now, if you're ashamed to be different, I will be ashamed of you someday. That's tough. That's hard. That's hard going, but that's what Jesus teaches. So another point here is that our King consecrates us for a special mission. So Jesus says, it's in the Old Testament, the Lord sets apart the godly for himself. I've got a mission for you. The U.S. Marines are a hyper-disciplined core of soldiers that have been given special training, And not just anybody gets into the Marines. I mean, you have to really be special. And then you go through training and boot camp, and they make you sleep in the mud, and they make you stay in the water. It's freezing temperatures for hours and hours till you think you're going to die. And they make you crawl under barbed wire with machine gun fire going over you and every kind of privation. I mean, you can't be a Marine and do what you feel. You just can't. You have to go without food. You have to go without sleep. You have to be pummeled and punished in every way possible to your body and your mind be rock solid and say, nope, I'm a Marine. I'm going to do this. I can do this. And you think you might die. Well, how do you think that the Marines go about recruiting people to join that? How do you think they recruit people? You think that they say, hey, young men, you can be a Marine. Anybody can be a Marine. It's easier now than ever. Sign up online. Take your little bit of preparation here with this neat little app or something, and keep up your job and everything else you're doing. It's wonderful. You can be a Marine. No, that's not how they recruit Marines. You know what their slogan is? The few, the proud, the Marines. And what they're saying is, if you want to be a Marine, you're going to have to be very different than most people. You're going to have to be tougher than most people. You're going to have to be determined in your mind that you are ready to take anything. And yet, how much Christianity in our world evangelizes just like that? They say, come on in, it's easy. It's wonderful. It's serve the Lord. There is no narrow door to squeeze through and get scraped and bumped on. Just bring it to God and commit it to Him and prosper in your American way of life. That's Jesus will bless all of that. And Jesus said, no, that's not what Jesus taught at all. He said, it's a rough little road. And I'm amazed at how sometimes this creeps into our own churches where there's real pushback into any kind of requirements. Well, you can't make these brotherhood guidelines because it's cramping people's style and it's bullying. It's you're just trying to make things constrained and difficult for people when there are church guidelines and so on. Well, actually, it seems to me that the kingdom is only for people who want to do hard things. The rest might as well not be in the kingdom because Jesus said, I'm going to ask you to do hard things because I'm going to do the hardest thing of all for you first. I'm going to let myself be whipped and nailed to a post and killed because you need it. You need me. And then when I'm resurrected, I'm going to give you the power to also be nailed to posts if that's what you come to. And to suffer many hard things to follow me because we're not like all the other people. It's a special calling. If any man will come after me, let him deny himself and take up a cross, follow me. So let's go to Matthew 6. Jesus taught that the desires of our heart determine our allegiance. Verse 19. Lay not up for yourselves treasures upon earth where moth and rust doth corrupt, where thieves break through and steal. Lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust doth corrupt, where thieves do not break through nor steal. For where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. And so we can serve the stuff that we have, the things that are here, or we can serve the kingdom of Jesus. And it's about an allegiance. It's about a loyalty to a king where our allegiance is. And so separation is possible, but not sustainable without a pledge of allegiance, our own pledge of allegiance to a king and his values. Go to Mark 14. Show you a real example of how this worked out in the time of Jesus here with the disciples. Mark 14 is the story of Jesus' crucifixion and his trial and all of this. And all about verse 27... Mark 14:27. And Jesus said unto them, all ye shall be offended because of me this night, for it is written,
I will smite the shepherd, and his sheep shall be scattered. But after that I am risen, I will go before you into Galilee. But Peter said unto him, Although all shall be offended, yet will not I. Jesus said unto him, Verily I say unto thee, This day, even in this night, before the cock crow twice, thou shalt deny me thrice. But he spake the more vehemently, If I should die with thee, I will not deny thee in any wise. Likewise said they all. And let's go down to there in the garden there. And Jesus said, Really, you know, could you not watch? You fell asleep already. It's almost like Jesus is saying, Hey, Peter. Hey, tough guy. You said you're going to go with me all the way. And we just get to the garden. I'm not even at the tough spot and you're sleeping. That's some kind of dedication. Look at verse 53 later there. Jesus is apprehended. He's arrested and taken into the castle. And we have 53 there. And they led Jesus away to the high priest, and with him were assembled the chief priests. And Peter followed afar off, even unto the palace of the high priest. And he sat with the servants, warmed himself with the fire. And chief priests and the council sought for witness against Jesus. And let's fast forward a little bit to 66. Verse 66, And as Peter was beneath in the palace, there cometh one of the maids of the high priest. And when she saw Peter warming himself, she looked upon him and said, Oh, thou also wast with Jesus of Nazareth. But he denied, saying, I know not, and neither understand I what thou sayest. And he went out into the porch, and the cock crew. And the maid saw him again, and began to say to them that stood by, This is one of them. And he denied it again. And a little after, they that stood by said again to Peter, Surely thou art one of them. For thou art a Galilean, and thy speech agreeth thereto. He began to curse and to swear, saying, I know not this man of whom you speak. Well, Peter, see, it's a little bit like this for us too sometimes. When I deny my association with Jesus, because, well, right here wasn't a very good time to be associating with Jesus, right? I mean, this was a good time to just have a little distance. But Peter, he's a little bit, he wants to be a little loyal to Jesus. So he's coming in afar off and he's watching how this might turn out. And the girl says, Oh, you're one of, you, I saw, no. What are you saying? No, didn't, I don't know who you're talking about. And you know, I think more than we want to realize that when we get into those circumstances in the world, in businesses, in work, and so forth, where we're willing to act like, I don't know what you're talking about, or maybe even curse and swear a little bit, not really, but sort of act like the world a little bit so that we're not, you know, won't stand out too much, camouflage ourselves a little bit, kind of stand at the edges, because, yeah, it could be kind of uncomfortable. Do people hunt in New York? You hunt in New York? Do you wear camouflage? Okay. What's camouflage for? Well, you boys tell me. What's camo good for? To hide. Aha. Good word. To hide. Because you don't want something to notice what you are. They want you to think you're a bush. Something else, right? Well, if I wear things that make me look like something else, a little less noticeable, harder to tell apart from the trees, harder to tell apart from the people on the broad road. If I use the world's slang and laugh at their jokes, their off-color jokes, and hang out at their rodeos and fairs and join in the water sports and all the fun things that they do, Then I'm sort of swearing like Peter. See, I'm just like you. Don't notice. I've already thought about it like this. I'm sometimes surprised how, and I know how it works. I've been born and raised in this too. But in the continuum of plain Mennonites to less plain Mennonites, sometimes I notice that people can act. I'll put it in a question form. If you were in a public place, at Walmart or Lowe's or someplace, and which would make you a more uncomfortable young men? Looking at the young men especially, which would make you more uncomfortable? that a stranger came up and actually thought you were an Amishman or somebody, you know, on the plain end of things. They mistakenly thought you were Amish. Do you have a car? Are you horse and buggy? Would that make you wince a little more? Or would it be that somebody came up to you and told you a really dirty joke because they didn't think you were a Christian? Would that make you uncomfortable? Which would you wince at a little more? That someone thought you weren't a plain person, or that somebody thought you were plainer than you think you are? See, I think sometimes we forget that we think that we're somehow here in some middle of the road separation, and we sure aren't that plain. That would be kind of embarrassing, you know. But, oh, no, we're not out in the world, but we're really careful that we don't get mistaken for something that is plainer than we think we are. And the truth of it is, who do you think you are more like in the kingdoms? The narrow way or the broad way? Are you more like the people that are driving the horse and buggies, really, in the kingdom of the world? Or are you more like the man who's going to tell you a dirty joke? Which are you more like? Which would you be happier to be mistaken for? See, that's the challenge. It's a matter of love. John says, just don't love those things, because if you love those things, the love of the Father is not in you. You can't love two masters. We're no match. We're no match for the devil's marketing. When the farmer, this may be a little bit in the past maybe, but we can follow this. When the farmer wants to catch a goose for Thanksgiving, how does a farmer catch a goose? Does he go out into the duck yard or into the barnyard with his axe and gets all aggressive and chases birds around and shouts at them and says, I'm going to get one of you and this is your last day, and he makes a big commotion and oh, no, that's not how a farmer catches a goose. You know how a farmer catches a goose? He puts the axe somewhere behind the door, and he gets a little container of grain, and he talks to them friendly-like and dribbles a little bit of grain around and gets him close enough and then grabs the goose. And the goose doesn't watch the farmer saying, why is he talking so nicely to me this morning? Why does he have a little bit of feed? What's up? Is that what a goose thinks? No. A goose doesn't realize anything until his neck is on the chopping block. Maybe not even then, but it's the nature of geese. They will follow foolishly all the way to the chopping block. And, you know, Psalm 73, well, I won't take time to turn to it, but Psalm 73, David was saying, oh, I looked at the wicked and, oh, they have money, and they have nice diesel pickups, and they have all the fun stuff, and they have nice houses, and the wicked, they just flourish. They don't even have trouble. They have everything just right. And then I saw the end. Then I saw them stretched out on the chopping block, and I said, oh, how foolish I am. Why didn't I see this? Why was I so mistaken by my estimates? And so it is. We're attracted to the delicious things. We're attracted because there's corn dribbled in front of us by the executioner. That's how we are. The prodigal son in in Luke 15, he saw only one set of things. Look at all the fun I could have if I had my money and my freedom. And I'm just going to live it up a little while. And so he said, hey, Dad, give me the money. I'm going to just go do some things for myself for a while. And he didn't see that all of this led to the pig pen ultimately and to misery and disease and starvation, because that's how it is when our hearts are focused on the loves. It's just short-sightedness. It's a very myopic view. We don't see as far down the road as the chopping block, like the goose. We only see the decoy. We only see the fun things. We only see the attractive things. Oh, that would look good if I spend that money on that thing. If I could do this. The entertainment. My heart, we say, we think, isn't affected by this. You know, I think sometimes the father of lies wants us to reason like this when we teach separation. And I'm not sure I like it. I think it's wrong, in fact, to teach that separation is something like this, that while we're here on the earth, we're going to forgo certain pleasures because we have a focus on if we deny ourselves some things here, you know, 60, 70 years, then we're going to cash in. We get to the eternal glory, and everything's going to be wonderful forever. And so just deny yourself a little bit here so that you have a bigger payout. Now, does that sound scriptural? I don't think it quite is. I'll give you an illustration. In 1972, Stanford University did this famous study in what they called the marshmallow experiment. And they got these children, young little children, and they brought them into the room with the counselor or whoever, and on the table was a very good-looking marshmallow. These were little children, you know, where marshmallows would really be special and irresistible. And they said, they talked to the child for a little bit, and they said, I need to go out for a bit, and I'll be right back. Don't eat the marshmallow. Because if you don't eat the marshmallow, if you let it alone till I come back, I'll give you a whole bag of marshmallows. If you eat the marshmallow while I'm gone, you don't get any more. And so they did it with hundreds of children. They did this same test to see which child would think through that. Okay, I could eat it now, or I could wait and get a whole bag. And it was a study in what we call delayed gratification. You know, if you say no to something now, you get something more later. And I forget what the percentages were. But then they followed that child, those children who did not eat the marshmallow. They followed their life through school a number of years and into college and into jobs to see if there was something about the nature of being able to say no to what you want right now, if that had some kind of character strength that followed through your life. Well, it did, no surprise. Almost 100% of the children who were able to say no to the marshmallow did better all the way through school and in through college and into their first jobs and so on than the ones who just had to have it now. Okay, so is that what the Christian life is like? I'd like to say that we're not going to impress our children with the essential nature of saying no to things now. In that way alone, and say, you know, children, young people, I know it's hard to wear, plain clothes and not get involved in entertainment and movies and TV and alcohol and sports and all that. I know it's hard, but just wait, and then it's going to be amazing when you die. Does that actually work? I don't know, you dads that have raised young people, is that kind of theory work? Say this, that convinces them, wow, you know, yeah, I'll wait. I just won't do this fun stuff now that the world says is fun. You know what's wrong with that idea? If we teach it that way, we are saying to our children that these things we're trying to have you not do, these things that we're trying to say, no, stay away from those things, we're saying inadvertently that, well, we know those things would really be fun. We know it would be pretty good, but, you know, just try to wait. But you know what the real truth of it is? Those things are not fun. All you need to do is go out to your, I don't know where you're, you have a county courthouse somewhere, and look at the parade of miserable people that go in and out of the county courthouse all the time. And their teeth are gone, and they're meth heads, and their families are messed up, and they're in there because they've been late on their child support payments, and they have three or four different children from three or four different girlfriends, and they're skinny, and they're shivering from their vices, and they don't have a job, and their cars don't work, and they're just miserable people. Maybe you don't have those in New York. Do you have any of those in your cities? Yes, the world is full of those people. Who are those people? They're the people that needed the marshmallow right away. All of them. And you say, oh, really? You think if I just have some fun, I'll end up in the county jail? Not everybody does. Well, that's true. Not everybody does.
But imagine if you were given this offer, which essentially Jesus does, that your life is basically one of two options, sort of like the game of chutes and ladders. Your life is one of two options, that you can either go through this little door and go through this steep ladder that narrow stairway that leaves you puffing and exhausted, and it's kind of hot and it's wretched and there's thorns to scratch you and so forth. But at the end, there's going to be music and light and friends and good times forever. Or you can go down this big, I don't know, like a water slide or something, this great fun slide that everybody else is on. And it's so much fun, you won't believe it. It's so much fun. Now, at the end, it dumps you into a burning lake of fire where you burn forever and can't die and everybody screams and it's miserable. But the slide is great. Would you get on the slide for a little while? Say, well, I'm going to try it out. I'll probably be able to jump off, right, before the end. Or would you say, seems like a catch there. It seems a little tricky. Well, Jesus said through John, blessed are they that do his commandments, that they may have right to the tree of life, may enter in through the gates into the city. For outside are dogs and sorcerers and whoremongers and murderers and idolaters and liars. And so, cleansing our lives from that which the world has to offer is always mockable. It's always mockable. There will always be somebody who says, oh, you're just being radical. We don't have to be that way. I mean, what do you want me to be, a monk? How separated do I have to be? What all do I have to say no to? The psalmist asks that. He says, I think I have cleansed my heart in vain. I mean, I looked at the wicked and they're not cleansing their hearts. They're doing what they jolly well feel like doing and they're just having a fine time. And here I've been fasting and I've been following the right ways. I've been denying myself these things and all I have is trouble for my efforts. And so that seems silly. And we do. We face a lot of pressure from evangelicalism in our day on our kind of lifestyle. Well, it's a works religion. You're trying to say it's about what kind of car, your technology, or the way you dress, or the way your family rules are, and so forth. That's a works religion. And the truth of it is that we can always be intimidated away from self-discipline by the accusation that, well, your church is so concerned about, you know, how you look and what you do. You ought to be concerned about the lost people. You need to go save the lost and not be talking about sweeping inside your house, you know, and discipline in the church and so forth. It's clear that you don't have a sense of mission in your hearts for all the lost people. If you would be focusing on evangelism, you wouldn't have to talk about church standards. Have you ever heard that? I've heard it many, many times, that it's one or the other, that churches either have a love for the lost and they're thinking about all the people they can go out and rescue, or they don't, and they're thinking about how can we keep our church just right and pure and you know, looking the way we want it to look and so on. And you know, that's an unfair and short-sighted characterization. It's not at all what Jesus taught. If it were true that it was an either or, then the churches that don't have any concern for internal discipline and order and self-denial let's say it this way. The churches that have their focus entirely on missions and evangelism would be the churches that have no problems in their own families, no marriage problems, no young people going astray, no losses. They would be the vibrant, growing churches. All intact marriages, all of the doctrinal stability of the scriptures. They would be strong and keeping their way. And they would have no power struggles in their leaders. They would have everything just working for them.
Well, is it the way it works? It doesn't. I'm going to conclude with a couple of questions. What does going through the little door mean in our time? In New York, right here in farm country, what does the narrow door look like anyway? Well, I think one thing it does is that, like Jesus asked of the people who followed him, step one was renounce the idolatry of possessions and wealth. Just renounce it. Come, rich young man, come with me. Oh, I'm sorry, you have too much stuff. So get rid of some things and then you can follow me. I think that's one of the most practical ways that Jesus has taught us that the narrow way involves getting rid of some idolatry of stuff. He condemned the man who said, I've had a good crop. We're going for bigger bins. He says the man's attitude was wrong. The stuff of this world will pay you well. The devil will pay you for your affection for a little while. But unless you seek the kingdom first, you could have that idol in your heart. You can't serve God and mammon. Jesus said, how hard is it to enter into the kingdom of God if you're rich? Now, quite admittedly, we here in America, of course, we're the richest people in the world. We have to almost find a way to explain away that verse. We have to. Because what are you going to do with it? That's what Jesus said. That rich people are going to have a very difficult time getting into the kingdom of God. And so we either have to say, well, I'm not really rich. I don't really have a lot of things. Those people have more. Or, well, I'm just not thinking about my pile of stuff. That doesn't have my heart. I don't think I have more than people around me. I'm not affected by that. Or that I didn't try to get rich. Right? I just worked and the business kind of grew and I know I'm worth several million, but I did try that. I mean, just being industrious and serving the Lord, and it happened. And so it's not that I'm an idol. I'm not idolatrous about this somehow. But I don't know. If we truly are the richest people in the world, we have the biggest pile of stuff. And we have nice houses, all of us do. I'm not making myself different. We live in America. 90% of the world, it's fair to say, absolutely. 90% of God's people on the earth have a lot less than we do. So we're in the richest topper, 5 or 10% of the world. No questions. We eat steak. We stretch out on lazy boys. Snore on plush mattresses in the air conditioning, ride to church on heated seats in the wintertime, whirlpool tubs, whatever. I mean, we live like kings compared to the rest of the world. We absolutely live unthinkable lives of luxury here in America. And I'm not sure what to do with that, because Jesus very plainly said, no, that's not going to work. You cannot live that way and enter into the kingdom if you're living a self-aggrandizing, self-spoiling, accumulating kind of a lifestyle. It's not going to work. And so I have to put that before on the altar and say, God, show me if I have too much stuff. Am I living like a king? Because, well, it's just sort of how we are here in America. Well, Paul in talks in Corinthians, I'm shifting gears now. Paul talks in Corinthians about separation is about coming out away from people who don't share your values. And so get away from the unclean, the ungodly. But Jesus has a balanced view to that. He says, oh no, I'm not going to take the church out of the world and take them away from the wickedness. No, he said, I'm going to give you the power to be lights in the world to the wicked people.
But it's true. Don't have association, close association, and friendship with the people that are wicked. Don't do that because it's going to poison you. And so the question is, who do you spend most of your social time with? Is it the sort of halfway ungodly people at work, your employees and bosses and so forth? Or do you find more joy out of spending time with people here in your brotherhood? I know how that can work. It's possible. Maybe you say, oh no, I'm associating mostly with God's people and so forth. Oh really? What about the fact that we live in the world where you can associate very, very closely with thousands of people through that little device in your pocket, and you listen to their podcasts, and you listen to their YouTube channels, and you listen to all this stuff, and you're imbibing what they have to say and their philosophy of the world, and sometimes it's funny, and sometimes it's clever, and so forth, but you are very closely associating with those people, and they may or may not be people in the kingdom. They may not be. Certainly network news is not. Anyhow, so separation means that we renounce the idolatry of stuff, the idolatry of ungodly people, and we associate in with the brotherhood. And we listen to them, because if anybody has your ultimate interest in mind, it should be the people here at Cornerstone, your other families. Do you believe that? Or do you see some competition? Do you think there's anybody here at your church that you think is sort of threatening to you? Really? A little bit threatening? Or do you think that they ultimately have your good in mind? Well, we could say a lot of practical things about what separation and dress and so forth looks like. I'm not going to do that. I think that you have a brotherhood here that can help you figure that out. That's what the brotherhood's for. Just reject the pride of life, the lust of the eyes, because those things have only one end, as Jesus taught. And I see a lot of families and churches, yes, in our own conference, that I think are struggling with an identity crisis. Who are we? Are we plain people, or are we maybe done with that a little bit? Are we sort of moderate, sort of have passed the time where plainness is important? Maybe we shouldn't be Mennonites. Maybe we should just be Christians and just sort of be, you know, saving the lost and not worrying about our identity too much, our separation, education, our financial habits, our worship patterns, many things. I sense a lot of eagerness to experiment in some of our circles. Let's just try something different. Because, well, why not? You know, let's try something different. I'll give you a test here in conclusion. When you think about the ways that you have been separate from the world or not in your past, when you were born into some, maybe you were born into a Mennonite family, maybe not. But if you think about your past, those of you that are over 20 or 40, at least 30, you think about your past. Ask yourself, am I currently living a life in what I allow myself to wear, how I allow myself to be entertained, my technology, my house, my lifestyle, my vehicles, my whatever, my job, my associations, where I go for vacations and so forth? How many of you, you don't have to raise your hands, how many of you think you're at a place today where you're allowing yourself a lot more of what American culture has to offer than you did when you were a little boy under your mom and dad? Anybody here like that? How do you feel about that? Was it progress? Are you closer into the kingdom somehow by the things that you gradually become more used to? Turn your eyes upon Jesus. Look full in his wonderful face
and the things of earth will grow strangely dim in the light of his glory and grace. Sing with me.
Turn your eyes upon Jesus. Look full in his wonderful face. And the things of
kneel for prayer.